So this is class number 8 in the second semester of the Analysis of Literature course. Today we begin to consider the literature found in what would be chapter 10, and we will be continuing to consider that in the next class. Your written assignment due by the class number 10 will be questions 1, 20, and 25 in the Analysis of Literature student workbook assignment for chapter 10. The format of your answers to those questions should be as follows. Question 1, write a one-paragraph answer to this question. Question 20 just requires a short answer, and question 25 a short answer. Now we are going to be considering some of the other questions, as well as just the short story itself. That is the short story, The Snows of Kilimanjaro, by Ernest Hemingway. I'd like to begin by just getting people's overall impression, how the short story affected them, or, you know, what were their overall thoughts. I will begin this discussion on this, just the general overview, with some of my own thoughts. In at least for me, reading this story was somewhat, I guess it reminded me at least of this Solomon's Book of Ecclesiastes, where he says, essentially, that all is vanity under the sun. It was, at least, it struck me as very depressing, and somewhat showing the futility of man when he has rebelled from God, ignored God, and man when without God's special revelation, the Bible, to direct him, and believing in that. Another thought, just as far as historically, in the 20th century, and Hemingway is a good example of much of what of 20th century writing and beyond, there did become there has become, you see a progression from, you know, early, let's say, 19th century literature or 18th century. There were, even though they were humanistic, they had typically, I'm speaking typically here, far more hope in what man could achieve. But in the 20th century, so many writers like Hemingway become a lot. Much of the literature becomes very pessimistic, and in some sense, it has been a response to the events of the 20th century, such as this one with World War I and the aftermath. There had been a great hope before World War I, and you know, even some after World War I, in terms of Woodrow Wilson, hope in terms of creating democracies and peace, and then the but people became disillusioned when it did not seem that was all panning out, and they had put all their hope in these things, and they were disappointed. That's my overall impression. What are other people's overall impression of this short? I should say, you know, one can tell Hemingway is there's much immorality in this, actually, and that is not a good thing. But like I say, if it has one, from my standpoint, if it has one redeeming quality, at least it does not present non-Christianity as resulting in something positive. One could, let's say, when we had read Huckleberry Finn, you know, it's sort of all's well that ends well. He's going to head out in the sunset to the west. Here, one is not left with the impression of that non-Christianity leaves you in such a good situation. What are other people's thoughts on this short story?
When I first read it, I thought it was the worst short story I had ever read.
What did you think?
When I first read it, I thought it was the worst short story I ever read.
It was the worst.
Worst, uh-huh, right.
Okay, any other thoughts? Obviously, this is, actually Hemingway himself considered this his best and short story. And obviously Hemingway is regarded in the 20th century as one of the great writers. I'm not sure if right now, you know, critics change as far as what they think, but I'm talking about mainstream humanist critics. But what other thoughts? Why did you think it was, if you thought it was a poorly written short story, why?
Well, I mean, it was, there were some parts of it that were well written, but overall I thought it was just very negative, coarse. I didn't really like it.
Right, well, it certainly was coarse and immoral in that sense. Well, when, again, you know, to feed on something like this would not be good at all. The only thing is, it's sort of to understand the history of the development of the trends of the world. This somewhat gives a sense of where how things have happened and progressed, not necessarily progressed in a positive sense, but developed. Any other thoughts?
Was that Parnell that just gave his opinion?
Okay, that was Calvin.
That was Calvin.
Well, I agreed that it was.
My first impression was like Calvin's too. I actually didn't get the last couple pages read, but for most of it I read. But I kept asking myself, why are we studying this? I too did not enjoy it. I thought it was. I guess that's a good thing because, my opinion pretty much stands as what you described it yours as too. Just the depressing killing, you know, and I guess it just was not Christian, and I think that's why I didn't enjoy it. There was just nothing there. You know, nothing that you wanted to dwell on at least.
Yes, well, Parnell, you have not given your thoughts.
I was going to say it was sad and sort of predictable, too. That you knew he was going to die. That you knew what the ending was going to be.
Okay. Yes. Well, and, you know, what is interesting, of course, is the fact, what does it say about society that this is considered a great piece of literary work of the 20th century?
Well, people's values have changed.
Right. I mean, at least in part, the reason this is whether, you know, we like it or not, and I don't like it either in terms of, I mean, but the question is, it's you know, in terms of the in terms of literary criticism and so forth, in terms of what, they, you know, modern 20th century and beyond English professors and so forth think that, you know, they consider this a great work. And so the question is what does it say about them? They probably empathize a lot with it, right? I mean, that is at least part of what, a reason for liking something is because it says something about the human condition. And it's something that people empathize with. And like I say, the only thing I have positive to say about it is it does present what man becomes and is in terms of what, you know, if they reject the gospel and just the vanity of vanities under the sun. Once that has been rejected, especially if someone is more realistic, and at least in some sense he was realistic, in another sense he wasn't realistic. He was not realistic for rejecting Christianity, but he was realistic in realizing the great amount of vanity and futility once he had, which there are some that don't. Okay. Well, let's begin then with some of these questions specifically. How is it obvious from the Snows of Kilimanjaro that its author is not a Reformed Christian? What philosophy does the short story reflect, and explain why? How do we know?
Well, not only the narrator, but also the subject of the story weren't Christians. The subject of it, who the author empathized with, was quite obviously didn't have Christian values or Christian worldview.
Well, what specifically? If you can give me some specifics. I agree with you. What are some specifics things that show that?
Drunkenness, adultery, that type of thing.
Okay, drunkenness, adultery. What about taking the Lord's name in vain? It's quite promiscuous use of Christ's names in vain. It's very blasphemous. So those are some of the specific acts in terms of the overall view, seemingly of the, definitely of the character. But in some senses, based on, and again, I know this is more question one, but are there autobiographical elements, do you think, to this short story?
Hemingway himself was an author, so.
Okay, and when did he live? And when did this Harry live?
They lived at around the same time.
Right. And what had Harry gone through?
World War I.
Right. And the aftermath. I'll say this is the same same period. So would you agree then that at least in some sense, obviously this is not, Hemingway this is not a true autobiography. But in some sense he's drawing upon some of his own thoughts and life experiences in this story, right? It's not like he's telling something that is very removed from him. Right. All right. Hemingway wrote The Snows of Kilimanjaro in 1938. Hemingway was part of what has been called the Lost Generation. What is the lost generation in American history? Does the short story, The Snows of Kilimanjaro, reflect the philosophy typical of the lost generation? What do you think? Do you think this seems emblematic or representative of what would be called the lost generation?
Well, the lost generation was sort of like born in...
Well, what it is people, let's say, who went through World War I, perhaps even participated in it, and became disillusioned both what they saw in World War I, as well as, and even perhaps more so, by its aftermath. Again, Woodrow Wilson had portrayed had thought this was going to be a great occasion to bring about a new, if you want to say, a new world order. And many people, there were many people who bought into this. But then they were obviously gravely disappointed. By 1938, for instance, what was happening?
Hitler was on the rise.
Right. I mean, by 1938, I mean, even one could see, in the 1920s and 1930s, one could see what was coming up if not already had started in both Asia and in Europe. And it would have effects in Africa. Well, it had worldwide effects. What was obviously coming about?
World War II.
Right. So here we were going. Okay, so, Woodrow Wilson, and I don't mean to just dwell on Woodrow Wilson, though Woodrow Wilson, you see, he came from a Presbyterian background, but he rejected biblical Presbyterianism. I mean, he was nominally a Presbyterian all his life. He was president of Princeton, but he had rejected...
Hemingway was president of Princeton?
Woodrow Wilson.
Oh, Woodrow Wilson.
What I'm saying here is Woodrow Wilson, he had thought, again, in his human... Because he had, though nominally Presbyterian, he had rejected historic Presbyterian and Reformed Christian faith. He had put his hope in what, humanism could produce. And by 1938, it was obvious all these hopes had been dashed. Hemingway, let me read to you what someone has said. In broader terms, the Snows of Kilimanjaro should be viewed as an example of an author of the lost generation who experienced the world wars and the war in Spain, which led them to question morality and philosophy. Hemingway in particular found himself in a moral vacuum when he felt alienated from the church, which was closely affiliated with Franco in Spain, and which he felt obliged to distance himself from. As a result, he came up with his own code of human conduct, a mixture of hedonism and sentimental humanism. Obviously, who won in the Spanish Civil War in the 1930s?
The fascists.
The fascists under Franco. And they were supported, by the way, very strongly by the Roman Catholic Church. Large elements of the more the Republican movement, which Hemingway had supported, there were large elements of atheistic communism in that. And so you had these, in some sense, you had the choice of two evils. You had fascism and with strong ties to the Roman Catholic Church, and then you had atheistic communism on the other side. To a certain degree, those were the terrible choices, and Hemingway had affiliated himself more with the Republican side in Spain, and they had lost. And so, after the loss, after all the things that had happened as far as World War I and the death caused there, and all the aftermath didn't work out. You had the rise of Hitler and so forth. Now, this is the historical context in which Hemingway writes, and that is why they're often portrayed as the lost generation. Not that certainly everyone responded in the way Hemingway did, but many leading intellectual thinkers certainly did. Let me read something someone else has written. The Snows of Kilimanjaro takes place in the decades between World Wars I and II. The First World War was a traumatic experience for Europe and America, for although it was fought largely in Europe, it involved almost every European nation, and at the time, the European nations controlled the vast areas of Africa and Asia. The war was remarkable for the sheer mass of killing it entailed. New technologies of war, including motorized vehicles, airplanes, and poison gas, were used for the first time. Probably most traumatic and senseless was the strategy of trench warfare. What the hope that had been in, of course, all the technology, it was actually used towards man's destruction. And that itself was disillusioning because people had put so much hope of what man could do and achieve in this technology, and here man was using it for self-destruction. Okay. All right. Who are the main characters in The Snows of Kilimanjaro?
Harry, obviously.
Okay, Harry. And what is his role?
He's the main character.
Probably. Yes, he is the main character of the story, the protagonist of the story. Describe just a little bit about him.
He's just waiting for death, and...
What does he have? What disease?
Gangrene.
All right, and where is he?
In Africa.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's gone big game hunting in Africa, and this is how he's dying. There are many... we'll get into that later. Okay, what's another character?
His wife.
Okay, and what's her name? Well, I'll tell you, Helen. Okay, and what is she sort of like?
She's willing to put up with a lot. She's rich.
Yes, she's willing to put up with a lot, and she's rich. She's, in some sense, grateful to be married to Harry. Any other main characters? Is there any other character? Obviously, those are the two main characters. Is there any other character that receives at least some attention?
Like Molo?
Okay. Perhaps even someone who gets more attention than that in this, on the overall short story.
Mabuan or something.
No, that's the other name for Harry.
Oh. At the end, I'll give you...
Compton.
Tell me about him.
He was sort of a subject in Harry's dream just before he died.
Right. So he's really not even... Of course, none of these characters are really real. But within the short story, he's a dream character, isn't he? Anything else? You have to say about Compton.
He's sort of deceptive. I don't understand exactly what that his dream didn't really have much to do with reality. It seemed to me.
Yeah. At least as portrayed in the dream, he came across as confident, and he makes Harry feel better that he can, you know, get out of his predicament. But of course, it was all an illusion. How does Hemingway reveal and develop the main characters in the course of the story?
Through conversation a lot. And then through memories.
Do they develop? Do the characters develop during the course of the story? When I'm asking this question, I'm specifically not looking for what techniques did Hemingway use? I'm rather asking, how characters can develop, let's say, looking in a physical sense, let's say this were a biography of George Washington, and it, you know, takes you from his childhood to his adulthood, that would be development. Okay, all right. Well, obviously, this short story, how does the character develop? What is the time frame of the story?
It's a short time frame.
In some sense, right? But in some sense, is it? Is in another sense, is it a longer time frame?
Well, he reflects on his whole life and time of writing.
And what's the technique used there, in some sense?
Stream of consciousness.
Well, maybe stream of consciousness, yes. But flashback, right? I mean, because when we look back, let me ask you this. When we have these sort of vignettes within the short story of looking back in Harry's life, is it simply that he is reminiscing? Or how do we learn about his past life?
Is he like dictating it to to his wife so then she can write it down. Is that it?
No, he's just dreaming.
No, he's just thinking it. But he's thinking it, right? He's thinking it in some sense as if he were there. Because it reads like it was snow too that felt all Christmas week that year up in the they were snowbound a week in this, and I'm just saying there I'm just reading little portions here. It's almost you're hearing the conversation in some sense of the past. But of course it's Harry dreaming about his past and sort of reliving those past incidences. So, getting back then to the question, how does Hemingway reveal and develop the main characters in the course of the story? Especially, I'm talking about Harry and Helen. How do they develop?
They don't really change much.
Okay, so you're of the view that that Harry, even including the period of the flashbacks?
Oh, no. In the flashbacks, well, he was much more active, of course, before.
Okay, he was active, and, all right, number one, he was active.
He was more hopeful.
He was more hopeful. What was he especially hopeful about doing in terms of his own personal life?
Writing.
Right, writing. And what had stopped him from achieving his objectives, according to him?
He had gotten lazy because he married a rich wife.
Right. That is what he alleges, is that because he had married this rich wife, that he never got around to writing. Then how would you then describe? So then now what we're seeing here in this short story, right, is the end of his life. And so what was it like at the end?
Well, he's sort of in despair that he could never write it.
Right. He's disappointed. He's in despair. He is somewhat. He goes from being angry at Helen to realizing it was his own fault, right? So that's sort of how Harry develops within the short story. What about Helen? Do we see more change in terms of Harry's frame of mind in this short story, or more change in Helen's frame of mind? What changes, especially if one includes the flashback, because we've sort of included flashback in Helen's life.
Well, she changed over time because, like, after her husband, after her husband's died, and then she finally decided to marry Harry.
Mm-hmm. Right. He gave her a new lease on life. She lived very immorally. Actually, she lived immorally after she got married, perhaps arguably in some sense less immorally. Again, there was just widespread immorality. I will say here, and it is a sad thing, but wars can tend to promote immorality in terms of lifestyle. It can. It doesn't have to. I'm not saying that every soldier becomes immoral by any means. I'm not meaning to say that. But, you know, you take.
Do you remember what Lori, when the boys went to engineering classes in Canada last summer, they noticed that even the counselors and the students, almost every other sentence there was a curse word. Mm. Now, considering these were public school students mostly, but. If I go to Jennison High School today, I do not think that I would hear that much cursing. And even if they did curse, they would curse probably privately, but not publicly. So we were talking to our minister about it, and he said cursing is very, very common among the non-Christians in Canada, and he said it originated when the men came back from war. Do you remember
that? Yes, World War One.
From World War One, the men coming back from World War One were cursing, and it promoted a culture in Canada that was, you know, cursing was acceptable.
Yeah, it is.
From World War One.
Yeah.
The thing is, what you've got is a situation, obviously. You've got a lot of men. It's very non-ideal circumstances in many ways. You've got a lot of men put far away from their spouses, if there are, you know, maybe they're, if they're not married.
From their parents.
From their parents, and you know, it's just, you've got, and it is historically, we were reading even about when we were reading the 30 Years' War, who would follow where the soldiers were? You remember?
Prostitutes.
Huh?
Prostitutes.
In the Philippines, near the military base, what does it have a reputation of being like?
A very immoral community. There were so many prostitutes.
Right. It is prostitutes.
In Vietnam, the same thing.
Yes. The sad thing I'm not saying it does not make it right. I'm not saying that one should. I'm simply saying historically it has been the case that it has tended to promote this sort of thing. So they're very non-ideal circumstances, and what can happen...
Boys, what book did Chaplin show? The boys are in correspondence with a chaplain in the Middle East right now, and they're raising funds to send something there. When they ask the chaplain, what book should we buy and send copies of for you to use with a Bible study group in Iraq or Kuwait, the chaplain said the book was entitled Every Man's Battle. And it is a book on sexual purity, because to combat, you know, pornography and all of that stuff.
Oh.
See, boys?
And, of course, the fact that now even women are allowed into this situation in terms of the military only makes matters worse. You can imagine, at least in terms of the trench warfare... in World War One, it really was all male. But now you're getting to the situation where females are sort of just put in the middle of this whole thing. And, of course, some would want even open sodomites to be able to serve in this situation. It just, you're in close quarters, you might die tomorrow. It's a very sexually promiscuous atmosphere too often. Again, have there been instances in history where that is not the case? There certainly have been. If one reads, for instance, about some of the Reformed Christian armies during the Protestant Reformation, it was not like this. But it really had to come from the top that this was not acceptable behavior, and it really had to, unless it came from the top, that it was not allowed, and if someone did engage in any of this, it was very quickly punished, then this sort of thing can typically happen. Okay. So, why, now another question. Why did Harry return to Africa?
He hoped it would reignite his writing.
Right. He had hoped that it would reignite his writing. But of course, he ended up dying there. So, what I'd like each of you to do then, tell me, or at least one of you, one or both of you, if you have something to add to the others, just give me an overall plot summary. If you had to just give a several sentence plot summary, give me a plot summary of this short story.
Well, Harry is lying in bed because of the gangrene, which had started because of a scratch on his leg. And then he and his wife are talking and he remembers all the his previous life experiences from like World War I and such. And then he dies.
Okay, let me read to you how one person has described the done a plot summary in one paragraph. Harry is a rider on safari in Africa with his wife Ellen. They are temporarily stranded when their truck breaks down from a burned-out bearing. While photographing a herd of waterbuck, Harry's knee is scratched by a thorn. Gangrene develops in his right leg. Harry attributes the problem to his failure to apply iodine to the wound. The rotting leg has an awful stench, but Harry denies any pain or horror. He is just angry and extremely fatigued. He resents his wife and maybe even her wealth and is verbally cruel to her. While he rests, she shoots a ram. Harry reminisces about the people and places in his past. He has multiple flashbacks and contemplates all the writing he had one day hoped to do about the many experiences he has accumulated in his life, but realizes nothing more will be accomplished. He senses the heavy presence of death. When a rescue plane finally arrives, Harry is transported over the summit of Mount Kilimanjaro, the highest mountain in Africa. But wait, it seems Harry was only dreaming. There is no rescue plane yet. Helen discovers that her husband has died in his sleep. Outside their tent, a hyena makes a strange noise that resembles the sound of a human being crying. So that's how one person has written a plot summary of this short story. Might be an example for if you're writing a plot summary of how you might want to write it. Okay. How does I mentioned in that paragraph about flashbacks. How does Hemingway employ flashback in The Snows of Kilimanjaro?
He uses it to inform the readers about their previous lives and the way that they had developed up till that point.
Okay. As opposed to, what would have been the alternative way of doing it?
Like starting back from...
Right. What are some advantages of doing it this way? And I'm talking out here in terms of writing technique. What are advantages of doing it this way as opposed to doing it that way?
It would probably have been longer. And it would have gotten to unnecessary details.
Right. And that's right. Even in terms of... By flashback, you sort of there is a level of suspense that's created because you are at the beginning, you're trying to muddle your way through what is even the case here, right? And the way you find out about these people is by a flashback. So it tends to create a sense of suspense of wanting to read further in order to understand the dialogue that's even happening in the beginning. Because isn't it hard to understand the dialogue in the beginning? We just these two people are conversing, and we don't really know anything about them. So it's a way of building a suspense and of getting the reader to continue reading to try to understand the thing, the starting point. There would be none of that if you just started from, okay, he was born in such and such city, Iowa, and he went to France, and da 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 da. Okay. Why did Helen go far away from Harry to shoot game for them, and what does this reveal about her character? Why did she go and shoot the ram?
Because they needed food, I guess.
But why did she not do it there? She could have done it right next to him. There was game that was within eyesight. Do you remember in the short story why she went away?
He wouldn't have. She she thought she wouldn't have wanted to see.
Oh, really? In other words, he was like an animal rights activist? Is that it?
No.
That's why they went down to Africa, because he was an animal rights activist? He was trying to protect all these animals? Okay, let me tell you. Do you not remember either?
I don't know. Was it the noise or
something? No, no, no. He liked to watch the game. If she had shot, what would have happened?
They'd have all gone away.
They would have all gone away, and he couldn't have watched them. So she went away so as not to scare off the animals in front of his view. Which, by the way, the very fact that they're on this big game hunting, just as an aside here, but how does it show what... When humanists have their own sort of morality, what is the nature of it? In terms of this big game hunting, what would it be thought of now? What is politically correct now versus then, let's say?
Well, now that'd be considered cruel.
Right, right. You know, in some sense, hunting is looked upon politically incorrect now. Whereas then... Was there such a strong animal rights activism? No. Okay, so, you know, on the other hand, was it more moral then? Was Hemingway, let's return to the morality of the 1930s of Hemingway. Is that it? No. But it's just interesting that, you know, what is considered politically correct among humanists in one time period is not considered politically correct in another time period. Man, in his fallen nature, you know, when he's going to create his own system of morality, it often changes from one time to the next. And it often is difficult, but because especially older people who have been humanist, you know, by the time, and when they were younger, they've had one system of morality. And then they get caught up in the problem of, by the end of their life, there's been a new system of morality, and theirs isn't inconsistent with that. Of course, some people just change with every humanist whim, but or whatever sort of the predominant trend is. But all right, what does Romans 2:15 indicate about human character to help explain why even non-Christians do such a thing as Helen did, and that is of being considerate for his feelings? Romans 2:15. Says, which show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience also bearing witness, and their thoughts the meanwhile accusing or else excusing one another. It's talking about the pagan Gentiles.
Well, even non-Christians have consciences.
Right. But on the other hand, is the fact that she was considerate in this way proof that the doctrine of total depravity is, as described in Romans 3:10-18, is not true? Which, of course, says... there is none righteous, no, not one. There is none that understandeth. There is none that seeketh after God. They are all gone out of their way. Their throat is an open sepulchre. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Destruction and misery are in their ways. Is that disproof?
No, I mean, it's not saying that people are as bad as they could possibly be.
Right. So the doctrine of total depravity is not that man is... in all times, in all ways, as bad as he possibly, you know, as one could possibly conceive. Rather, what is the doctrine?
That people are completely depraved, every part.
Right, every aspect of their being, in terms of their will, their understanding, their affections, are all depraved and corrupted and... that the dominating tendency of them is to go in the direction of immorality. But it is not saying that that it is not certainly denying that they have a conscience, even though that conscience is warped. But it's not always wrong. We had talked about how Harry got gangrene. We've also talked about Compton. I think we will stop our class here today. We're going to be finishing this short discussion of this short story in the next class. Are there any further questions? Any questions about it or comments? Additional comments? Okay, great. Well, if there are none, we will then close today's class.